This is Queen Elizabeth, speaking to you from the 16th century. Nothing displeases me more than history myths. And you know what I do when I get displeased? Get an axe and chop off some heads? No! I summon Professor Buzzkill, who explains everything. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again. Join me in listening to a new episode.
Yes, it's me. It's Professor Buzzkill here. What's more important, though, is that we have Heath Hardinge Lee on the line over the internets, whose second book, The League of Wives, The Untold Story of the Women Who Took on the U.S. Government to Bring Their Husbands Home from Vietnam, is out now, and we're promoting it on the Buzzkill Bookshelf. And fortunately, Ms. Lee came on the show to talk about the story. Hello, thanks for coming.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, it really is an untold story. You know, we see an awful lot of books have that subtitle, the untold story this, the untold story that, and so often it's just a ploy to sell more books. But this is genuinely something that really needs to be more widely known.
Oh, thank you. I think so too. These women need credit for what they did.
Well, can you tell us first of all who these women were?
Certainly. So the League of Wives that I reference in the book are a really courageous group of wives of American POWs and MIAs during the Vietnam War. So we're talking mostly conservative military wives across the military branches, but primarily Air Force and Navy wives who go to bat for their husbands who are shot down or they are captured during the Vietnam War and held prisoner at the infamous Hanoi Hilton. And many are there as long as 7 or 8 years. And the women get tired of waiting, get tired for our government to do their job and get them out. So they take matters into their own hands.
Now, one of the things that's so interesting in the first part of the book is that you describe something called the role of the, quote, the right wife in the military at the time, and that this taking matters into their own hands sort of goes against that. What was the role of the right wife in the military?
Oh, yes. I had so much fun with this because, you know, I'm a big fan of, I mean, it was just a field day. You know, I had so much fun writing about this. I'm also a big fan of Tom Wolfe, of the writer, nonfiction and fiction writer, Tom Wolfe, who wrote The Right Stuff. So right wife was really a play on The Right Stuff.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yes. So the men in The Right Stuff, the astronauts, have the right stuff, what it takes to get the job done. And these women are the right wife. But I also say that ironically in the beginning, because the right wife in the 1960s, meaning the military wife as she should be during that time period, the right wife had to be beautiful. It wasn't a requirement she be smart, but she needed to be beautiful. She needed to be a good cook, a good hostess, a good mother, and needed to pretty much be submissive to her military husband and do whatever it took to move his career along. Of course, she did not have a career. That was not really appropriate.
Her
job was to help him do his job. So when I say the right wife in the early chapters, it's really with irony and a play on the right stuff. So that's where we start, but that's not where we end.
Well, what I found so interesting and amazing is that you describe these things called protocol guides. These are written protocol guides for military wives in the 50s and 60s. What were those like? Was it really sort of an instruction manual, how to be a military wife?
Yeah, totally. They're instruction manuals. And they're 100% serious, which is really, you read these now. And I'm a creator as well as a writer. And so I was looking at these as artifacts, you know, trying to keep my now eyes from popping out of my head because these things were just so sexist and so ridiculous and just impossible things to do or to follow up on. But the protocol guides, they had these for each branch of the military service, had one of these protocol guides for the wives. So there was the Air Force wife, the Army wife, the Navy wife, and the Marine wife. They were all written by these same two women who, by the way, were military wives themselves. And they're really, they're instruction manuals with a lot of helpful information, but they're also propaganda pieces about how to behave, how to act. They're reinforcing the gender stereotypes of the time, but they're also trying to have the women conform to what the military would want so that she knows her primary job is to help him, the serviceman, do his job. That's the point. But the two together is a blend that no good writer could resist. It was just so you know, just not even, you just show people these manuals. You don't have to tell them how silly they were. Even at that time, they were a bit out of date. They were really more from the 50s and then trying to take it into the 60s. So that's where we start.
So you start with this group of women who not only have to fulfill this role of the right wife, they've been given written / published information how to do it, yet their husbands are fighting this new and in many ways very different war from the Korean War and certainly from World War II.
Yes. Exactly right. This war is not your parents' war, I say in the book.
No,
it is not World War II. It is not even Korea, where in these two cases, POWs, prisoners of war, were held for much shorter periods of time. And there is something called the Geneva Convention, started long ago, that has rules of engagement, rules of treatment for prisoners. Things like prisoners are required to have regular mail, required to be fed appropriately and housed appropriately and have medical care. So in previous wars, believe it or not, the Geneva Conventions were at least something that everyone had agreed to and were at least semi-followed. Not always, but a good deal of the time, people respected that. When you get to Vietnam, it's all bets are off. This is just a totally different war. It did not work like any of the Cold War era wars did. It was a different type of diplomacy that was needed that our government just could not wrap their heads around. And it wasn't even diplomacy that it was needed. It was public embarrassment, which we can talk about later. We'll get to that, I'm sure. But it was not your parents' war. It was, you could not have any applicable templates from previous wars with the war where the Geneva Conventions meant nothing and the North Vietnamese just made a mockery of all those rules.
Okay, well, we're talking about, and we don't want to give away too much about the individual women because, of course, we want Buzzkillers to get the book. We don't want to give away the whole story.
Right.
But these are women whose husbands had been shot down and captured. Right. In the war. Once that happens, what sort of issues did they face right after the husbands were shot down?
Right after the husbands are shot down, these women are told by Lyndon Johnson is in power at this time. So Kennedy is assassinated in 63. Johnson is his vice president. So during the war, when my women are starting, we start really in 64 on. So Johnson is in charge. His administration is using an old policy based on the keep quiet policy of previous wars, where if your husband, son, brother was taken prisoner or was missing in action, you were not supposed to say anything to anyone about their whereabouts, what had happened, any of that stuff. Now, that was hard enough in previous wars where people were not kept for a terribly long time. But in this war, these guys would be in there some as long as 8 years. There was just no possible way to keep quiet and not tell anyone but your immediate family. So the length, the duration that the prisoners were kept here determined a whole different strategy. So that policy was enforced by the Johnson administration. So that was one thing they faced. Probably the biggest thing was being forbidden to communicate about that. Other things I talk about were more psychological. Other military wives would not associate with the POW or MIA wives. It was almost like a fear of infection, like a virus spreading.
Really?
If one person was shot down, perhaps it could happen to them too. So I thought that was an interesting kind of psychological phenomenon with the wives. Those are just two big examples of things that they faced. And of course, not being able to get their paychecks, their husband's paychecks. lots of financial issues.
I didn't know that.
Oh, gosh, yes. There was, for instance, the 10% savings plan. All servicemen in combat zones during this period could contribute, have their families at home contribute money to a savings plan that had a 10% interest rate. So, of course, everyone wanted in on that. But the POWs and of course, MIAs, if they knew they were MIA, were not allowed, their families were not allowed to participate in the savings program just for no good reason, really. I mean, because the POWs weren't contributing to the economy, because they were in prison, because the MIAs didn't have a forwarding address. I mean, it was ridiculous. But even when confronted with this, the government, the Comptroller General still ruled these families could not participate until this League of Wives got involved, and they did fix that within a year and a half. But that's just an example of government neglect that they faced immediately.
And that's neglect bordering on cruelty because, I mean, after all, these are prisoners of war. It's not like they've gone AWOL or something.
No, these are heroes, you know, and they're treated so poorly throughout, just ignored, you know, no attempt to rescue them till the very end of the war. I mean, it's just unbelievable how the government neglected them. And that was a bit on purpose because, you know, LBJ, we learn, you know, later when you study his presidency, of course, Vietnam puts the nail in his political coffin, ends his career.
Yeah.
So he wanted to shove this under the rug, the POW issue, because it made him unpopular. It just made him look bad. So there were a lot of politics involved in why the country did not do more under Johnson for the POWs.
So can we talk more about, of course, you, because you're the expert. Can you talk more about LBJ's attitudes towards the POW MIA wives in particular?
Oh, yes. One of my favorite topics. It was hard to stay neutral, you know, writing this.
Yeah.
I always try to do that politically. I don't put my opinions, but I am reflecting the opinions of the POW MIA wives on LBJ when I write about them.
Right.
But he, you know, his focus was his great society programs, his domestic programs, and many of which were very laudable, the Head Start program, the Civil Rights Act. These were great, but he wanted that to be his focus. He was not good at foreign policy, did not want to engage in this horrible quagmire-like war, and it was ruining his career. So,
yeah,
you know, he left not only the POWs and MIAs out of this great society, but women as well were just looked upon as second class citizens. He really didn't believe any of the civil rights stuff either. I don't think particularly in terms of its application to women. We were very much still second class citizens. So he demonstrates that throughout the book. So you can read lots of examples of that kind of behavior. He actually only had one picture I could find with the POW wives. And when I asked the staff at the LBJ library about coming to research, they said, don't bother. He never spoke to these wives. We have nothing, no transcripts. We don't have anything to show you, which was pretty shocking. So
is there any evidence that the wives addressed him or sent missives to him?
Oh, many letters, pleas for help, pleas for meeting with them privately or in a group. And I believe he did meet maybe with one or two, but never would he meet with the group as a unified group. He refused to meet with them. What if they became hysterical or started screaming or freaking out?
Yeah, and that's the way certainly someone LBJ would think that. Yeah.
Yes. He did not want a hysterical woman on his hands. He could not handle that, nor could his staff. So, he was just worthless about having any kind of sympathetic meeting with them at all.
Okay, but this is a good place for us to take a little break because we'd like to talk in more detail about, first of all, how things change later on and more about this keep quiet policy, which is fascinating. But we need to take a little sponsorship break and we'll be back in a minute. You know that we're sponsored by the Great Courses Plus, Buzzkillers. You know it's a fantastic streaming service. You know that I love it very much. One of the reasons I love it very much is I'm getting to explore new things. I'm getting to explore new things presented to me by real professors who really know their stuff, really have spent years studying the field, and they know how to teach and engage with me. For this episode, for today's Professor Buzzkill episode, one of the relevant Great Courses Plus courses is called The Skeptic's Guide to American History by Dr. Mark Stoller from the University of Vermont. In that, he has two fantastic episodes. One, The Real Blunders of the Vietnam War, which explains why did America fail in Vietnam. You not only learn, you know, the answer to that question, but you gain a much more nuanced understanding of why the debate still rages. And the follow-on episode, Myths About American Wars, shows that Vietnam really isn't the only misunderstood war in American history. This episode delves into common myths and misunderstandings shared by many Americans about why the nation's wars have been fought and how the results have been judged. But it's not all history for me in the Great Courses Plus. I've just discovered a great course called Black Capital, African Americans in Washington, D.C., including, I think, the best episode, the episode that Lady Buzzkill and I like the most, called From the Look of Things, in which D.C. native and award-winning artist Nikisha Durrett shows her decades of changing the definition of art in the community in D.C. has helped us fully appreciate the heritage of African Americans in that important city, and perhaps the most important city in the United States. It absolutely opens my mind every single time I find a new course in the Great Courses Plus, and I can't recommend it highly enough. So what do I want you to do? I want you to sign up for the Great Courses Plus. Hit the pause button on the podcast. I never ask you to do this, but do it now. Hit the pause button. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. As a buzzkiller, you can check out any course or lecture for free. Free. Okay? Free access to their entire library. Again, don't wait any longer. Sign up thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. Now back to the show. Okay, Buzzkillers, we're back with Heath Hartage Lee, who's talking to us about her fabulous book, The League of Wives, the untold story of women who took on the U.S. government to bring their husbands home from Vietnam. And before we left, Ms. Lee, we were talking about LBJ's policy towards MIA and POW wives, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But throughout the first part of the interview, you kept referring to this thing called the military's keep quiet policy. I found it extremely fascinating in the book, and I think Buzzkillers would like to hear more about it.
Oh yes, well it's so topical today too in so many ways. Mm-hmm. All these different movements, like Me Too particularly, it's like keep quiet, shut up, don't say anything, which was the government, the LBJ government, telling the wives from the get-go to not talk about what had happened to their husbands. Nothing about this shoot down or capture, if they were a POW or an MIA in Vietnam, to anyone except their immediate family. And then you had to do this for up to 8 years. I mean, this was ridiculous and was not going to work long term. And the wives know this. They are smarter than the government people giving them the runaround, who really still have a sort of older view of diplomacy. They think if the wives say anything, that it could derail negotiations with the North Vietnamese, or it could result in executions or torture. Well, that makes sense for a while. But after about 2 years, Sybil Stockdale, at the center of the book, is the one who goes public on her own, not with the government really exactly behind her. They know she's going to do it. Naval intelligence knows she's going to do this, but she really is on her own. So in 1968, Sybil Stockdale goes to the San Diego Union newspaper and goes public with not the fact that the men are being tortured, which she knows at this point because she's been coding secret letters to her husband.
Oh, wow.
So we can talk about that maybe a little later. But she knows just beyond a shadow of a doubt the torture's going on. She doesn't go so far as to say that in this particular public declaration. But what she says is The North Vietnamese are ignoring the Geneva Conventions of War, and the world should know. So she leaves it a little more vague at this point, but she lets everybody know what is going on and that this is unacceptable and that this is her husband who is a POW. And that is much more than anybody has heard before. So that's the beginning of the go public phase, which at this point is just the women doing it. Later, the government will join in support, but not at this point. It's a very brave thing for her to have done.
Well, but how then did this policy change under President Nixon?
Yes, this was one of the most interesting parts of the book to me. I'm 50, so I was born in 1969 and kind of in the middle of the war and was just not really conscious of anything, of course, and didn't know much about President Nixon at all, except for, you know, what you hear all the time. So I was really interested to see what a difference it was between the LBJ administration and the Nixon administration in terms of the POW, MIA wives in that community. As Sybil Stockdale said in her diary, the Johnson administration, she says, dark, dark days under Johnson, bright, sunny days under President Nixon, which was so interesting. I was like, wow, that's something I have never heard.
But
President Nixon does, he was a Navy veteran. He was always extremely supportive of the military, very empathetic with them, had seen, had been in the Pacific and seen some major battles. He was not fighting in them, but he was sort of in the midst of some of these. So he knew a lot of people that died in the war and did not come home. So I think he had a natural empathy that LBJ did not for this community. And also politically, these women are that silent majority that he will talk about in a later speech.
Yeah, that's right.
Conservative, middle America. Yeah, these are his people. You know, there's a connection there with the values and the politics. And he, unlike LBJ, is much politically much more astute in dealing with these women. He also really respected his mother, his wife, Nixon, adored his daughters. So there's been a fair amount written. Evan Thomas writes about this in his book about he really liked strong women and respected them. So there are a number of reasons why Nixon is on their side. The biggest, though, is that the POW-MIA issue is a unifying factor for the whole country. And remember, the country's a mess right now. It is super divided. There are all kinds of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people protesting on the mall, protesting the war. But this is the one issue of the Vietnam War that everybody could agree on, that we needed to get these people out, the POWs, and account for the missing. And what can be more appealing than these POW wives? They're the perfect spokeswomen for the movement.
You said before the break that the leader of the group went public in 68 with the San Diego newspaper. But then in this part of the book, you talk about how the other wives go public in the media. Is that because they think that the atmosphere is more right now for them to go public, not just one of them, but for all of them to go public?
Exactly. So that's exactly right. Sybil leads the way. And by the way, she's the senior POW wife, which, you know, in the hierarchy at that time and still sort of today, your rank reflects your husband's rank. So Sybil, being married to Jim Stockdale, who's the highest ranking naval POW, takes over immediately with the other Navy wives in the area. So the hierarchy is there for Sybil to go public first because of her position. When she goes, everyone follows. And that, you know, that's where the military hierarchy can really work well. Everyone sort of knows their place and knows to fall in line behind Sybil. And they follow her lead. So once she does it, the floodgates open and people everywhere, even who are not even just in the Navy, in the Air Force or the Army, they all sort of come out and are ready to go public, are ready to talk to other people, to go to Kiwanis meetings or to church and talk about the situation. And what they find is most people in the country don't even know that they're POWs, which is pretty shocking. Like they just don't even know, because there really aren't 591 POWs that come back. So they're not too many. A lot of people are just ignorant about this.
Oh, this is amazing. So the going public aspect really changes not only how they're represented in the administration and what might happen with their husbands, but how the rest of the public knows about this. They really sort of blow the cover on this or blow the lid off this issue.
They definitely blew the lid off the issue, and in a big public way, which, mm-hmm. you know, is not something, of course, the LBJ government's is on the way out and then on the way out. So they just give up. They realize they've been defeated. But what Nixon does that's really cool is he gives them a bigger platform, support, not lots of money or anything like that, but the government platform, the press conferences he starts doing with them, he gives them the spotlight that they hadn't had so much before. And just having the administration behind them and supportive is a huge sea change that buoys them up psychologically as well. It's a huge morale booster. Right. So that's what I found, you know, so interesting about what a huge change there was between LBJ's administration and Nixon's.
Okay, well, like I said, we don't want to give away too many things about the book because there's so much more in there, and it's absolutely, as I say, a gripping read. What long-term effects do you think the women of the League of Wives had on the role of military spouses?
Yes, and this is the part of the book, right? This kind of comes right at the end. I won't give everything away where I kind of
okay.
you know, have a thesis the whole time that is borne out at the end. Through Senator John McCain and lots of other documentation about the women. But to backtrack a little bit, I mean, they really changed the role of military spouses forever. There is the template mm-hmm. that we start with, the right wife, the Navy wife, the, you know, the Air Force wife, these very old-fashioned, they're really 1950s ideals that are carried through till about 65 about military wives and how they should act. And it's basically shut up, stay out of sight, you know, be seen and not heard like a child would be. And the kids are included in that definition. Just stay out of the way. But once this happens, they are seen as diplomats, as lobbyists that
I see.
Jobs. Right. And they also have been coding secret letters to their husbands in prison. So they are not, I wouldn't call them spies, but they are covert activists. So they mm-hmm. are all of these things that you couldn't imagine before that a conservative military wife could do all these things. And of course, they're all very smart women that are highly capable. And by the end, they are world-class international diplomats. So they change along with that. As they change the role of the spouses to be active, demanding some kind of accountability, not just passive sort of arm candy that mm-hmm. is the way they were seen before. So there's that role change on that. Then there is a very important, at the end when the war is over and they are signing the Paris Peace Treaty, one of the biggest things the women lobbied for was to require from the North Vietnamese that the POWs be returned. Now, crazy mm-hmm. me, mm-hmm. I didn't realize that in previous wars, that isn't always a condition of ending the war. I thought it was always a condition of ending the war.
Yeah,
it is not, right? It's like a legal contract. If you don't write it in, it's not there. So the wives would not support the Nixon government ending the war until he and Kissinger, Henry Kissinger, his national security advisor and Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, when he went to Paris to sign those, he knew he had to get the North Vietnamese to agree that all 591 POWs would be repatriated, and equally important to the women was the missing, that the missing be accounted for as best possible. Now, that was the best they could do, and considering later that we lose the war, Saigon falls, that promise is not able to really be carried out. But it was in the peace treaty. It was agreed to. So they make sure that is in there. And then the third thing is the torture that's going on. The wives know about it through these coding, these secret letters. They pass that information along to the government. Everyone knows the torture is going on, and the mm-hmm. wives are able to go public and embarrass the North Vietnamese into some kind of compliance. And by 1969, right, thanks to the wives, the torture stops. They are the main reason. There are other reasons the torture stops, but the wives' relentless PR campaign to let people know the Geneva Conventions are not being observed stops the torture. So those are the three main takeaways from the League of Wives and what they're able to accomplish.
Well, and we can encourage the Buzzkillers enough to go get the book, because every single thing that you've said so far in the entire interview has great depth behind it in the book itself. So it's the story of all the wives, not just the leading few, is the story of all the things that are going on in the LBJ and the Nixon administration. And especially, I think the way the wives go public and their effect in the media is just the depth of that and the breadth of that is eye opening when it comes to trying to study the Vietnam War period.
I appreciate that. I think so too. I think it's a model too for how do you use the media effectively. You know,
right.
It's pretty brilliant and early, very early. And
yeah, very, very early. Well, it just remains for me then to say thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you. I have so enjoyed this.
I'm glad you have. We should remind the Buzzkillers that any of you out there who are Patreon members of Buzzkill Society, can of course request to be had to have your name put in a drawing for a free copy of The League of Wives, which we're gonna draw a name out at soon after this episode comes out. And again, thank you very much. The book is on the Buzzkill bookshelf. We hope that we can talk to you when your next book comes out.
Oh, I would love it. I'm working on Pat Nixon's bio next.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
I would love to come back and talk to you about Mrs. Nixon, who is fascinating.
All right. Well, we'll make sure to put that in the schedule, and we'll say to the Buzzkillers out there that we will talk to them next week.